ॐ भद्रं कर्णे पश्विनुयामदेवा भद्रं पश्येमाक्षभिर्यजत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टुवागुंसस्तनूभिः व्यशेम देवहितन्यतायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तारक्षो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः.
So we are on chapter 2, verse 33. I will be going back and to 32 as we're doing this, verse 33. Let's start with 33.
Bhavayurasadbhirevayam advayena chakalpitaha advayena chakalpitaha bhava apyudvayenaiva bhava apyudvayenaiva tasmat advayatha shiva tasmat advayatha shiva bhavayurasadbhirevayam advayena chakalpitaha advayena chakalpitaha bhava apyudvayenaiva bhava apyadvayenaiva tasmat advayatha shiva tasmat advayatha shiva bhavaihi asadbihi eva ayam advayena cha kalpitaha bhavaha api advayena eva tasmat advayatha shiva. Shankara introduces this shloka saying, Purva shloka tasya hetu maha. What is the reason? He goes, what is the reason for the meaning of this previous shloka? The previous shloka, the previous verse says, there's no dissolution, there's no creation, there's no laya, there's no creation, na nirodaha, na cha utpatihi, there's no bondage, there's no seeker, there's no seeker, there's no mumukshu, there's no liberation, there's no muktaha. This is the absolute reality. It says esha paramartata. The absolute reality is this. There's no creation, there's no dissolution, there's no bondage, there's no liberation, and there's no seeker either. This is the absolute reality. So how is that? that's Shankara. Introduction. What's the hetu for this? You know, why is this even being said? And so, in this verse, he says this. Ayam means ayam, this atma, right? So bhavaihi asadbihi eva ayam, this very atma, eva ayam, this atma, kalpitaha, is imagined to be. Kalpitaha means really the adhyasa. This atma is taken to be, is assumed to be, is projected upon. All of this for kalpita. What? It's taken to be, it's imagined as, it's projected, it's assumed to be all of these bhavas, all of these things, which are asat. This self is taken to be all of these things, so many things, that themselves are asat, have no existence, no separate being in reality. And, he says, and this self is also taken to be kalpitaha, non-dual. If this atma is taken to be the non-dual self, if that's imagined, and it's also taken, that's a projected, that's a vritti in the mind, let's put it this way. And it's also, because of ajnanam, it's also taken to be things that, bhavas, things that have come into being, which by their nature are asat, means mitya. So this self is taken to be Brahman, non-dual, and it's taken to be also, because of ajnanam, mitya, all of these things that are mitya. And then in the second line he says, bhavaha also, bhavaha api advayena eva. He says, and all of these objects also, all of these objects also, they are taken to be advaya, means they are taken to be real. So these, all of these objects are taken on, are superimposed on the non-dual self. So all of these objects themselves are taken to be satchit, existent being. And then the self also is taken to be, is kalpita, is assumed to be these objects, and it's also assumed to be the non-dual self. So this is, it's a really incredible verse. Then he says, therefore, tasmat advayata, the non-duality is auspicious. It's non-duality, it's the advaya, the non-dual, that is auspicious, is Shiva. That's the verse. So this is going to really go into an absolute standpoint, because if we think, this is the premise of this, this is the vision of this. Your being, consciousness, the Atma, the conscious being that you are, is non-dual. Non-dual means it is one without a second, it's just pure satchit. It's not thinking anything. Consciousness is not saying, I am non-dual. And consciousness is also not subject to ignorance saying, you know, I am this body, mind, sense, organs. Consciousness is not making a mistake, and consciousness is also not correct. It's not correct, it's not incorrect, because from the standpoint of consciousness, there isn't even a vritti there. There is only consciousness. And so this idea of I am Brahman, or I am the body, or I am the, you know, the body-mind complex, this knowledge and ignorance belongs to Maya. That I'm a jnani, that I'm an ajnani, this belongs to Maya. That I know myself as Brahman, or I take myself to be the physical body, this is all mithya. This all is just from the standpoint of the jiva that is experiencing this world, right? And in experiencing this world without self-knowledge, all of these bhavas, all of these things I can identify myself with. This body enjoys consciousness, therefore I am this body. I, the conscious being, I am this body. Who's saying that? Is conscious being saying it? No. The mind is saying it. The mind, which is experiencing this world, experiencing this body, experiencing its own vrittis, experiencing its sense organs, is making a statement. And the statement it is making is based upon the reality of its experience, which is that this physical body enjoys me, which it does. Enjoys me, the conscious being, so therefore I am this body. That's a statement that's taking place. The ahankara, the mind, is coming, the buddhi is coming to that conclusion, based upon one's experience, right? And then upon knowledge, what happens is, the same buddhi, the same mind, that it says, I am the body, or I am the prana, or I am the mind, or I am the sense organs, or the karyakarana sangata, all of these things that, where I'm identifying with one upadi or another, you know, with knowledge, what happens is, all of these things become objectified, through viveka, differentiated from my own being, reduced to mitya, reduced to enjoying a dependent reality on myself, that all that viveka and everything all becomes very clear. And then that buddhi says, no, I am the advaya atma. I am the non-dual atma, really free from all of these things. In fact, all of these things simply depend upon me for their being, their mitya. They have no independent reality. They're asat. From their own standpoint, they're asat. They are not real. What is real is my own being. So here the buddhi is in, again, a statement, this particular statement of the buddhi, this recognition of the buddhi, is correct. It's based upon jnanam. It's based upon knowledge. It's recognizing, differentiating the nature of what is satyam, what is really. It's recognizing the clay and differentiating the pot from the clay, basically. So like that, I'm able to, through knowledge, able to differentiate all of the upadis from their substance and recognize the difference, the satyam mitya, recognizing that all of these things are dependent on me. But who's making the statement? Who is making the statement? Well, the mitya buddhi is recognizing, either not recognizing through a jnanam, this mitya buddhi, is recognizing erroneously that I am this body, mind, sense organs, and I am walking around in this physical world, you know, and that's my reality. Or that mitya buddhi has gained self-knowledge, mitya self-knowledge, right, to recognize that actually this is all mitya, and I'm the satyam, and nothing ever happens to me. So this whole, the whole knowledge itself, the ignorance and the knowledge, or something that belonged to the buddhi, that belonged to the jiva, not to the awareness, not to the me, that is the self of all of that. From my standpoint, from the standpoint of conscious being, of the me, I am not making a statement one way or the other. I simply am. And in fact, when the buddhi gains knowledge, it gains knowledge of my own amness, which is not making a statement. It gains knowledge of that. The reason it can gain knowledge of me as I am is because I am self-evident. I'm really the conscious being because of which all of these things are illumined. But the consciousness, the clay of the pot, is not itself engaged in any type of dialogue, is not interested in knowledge or ignorance, is non-dual, you know. And so from the standpoint of myself, this problem doesn't exist. So both this Atma is non-dual versus this Atma is, you know, super, is imagined. Say it like this: the Atma is imagined or is recognized or is taken to be non-dual, or it is taken to be one with, to be the all of these objects that themselves are a sub. Who is doing the taking here? And that is the buddhi, which itself is mitya, right? So both, I'm the non-dual Atma, or I am the body, mind, sense organs. Both of them are kalpita. Both of them are statements made by, conclusions made by the buddhi. One conclusion is correct in the sense that it is pointing to me, the non-dual Atma. But the non-dual Atma that I am doesn't make statements. See what I mean? It doesn't make statements. This is a statement. You know, I am this body or I am Brahman. The buddhi needs to be able to make a statement like this to be able to gain this knowledge, because the buddhi feels bound. In fact, the buddhi is bound. If you can say something which is mitya, something that has no intrinsic reality apart from satyam, can be legitimately bound, you know, if we accept that it can be legitimately bound, then it certainly can say it, accepts it from its own standpoint. The buddhi says, buddhi means your mind, your intellect. It says, you know, I am bound and I want to be free. It is the one that is having the problem, you know. The problem, though, is the one who is having the problem is mithya. Of course, if the one who is having the problem was not mithya, there would be no solution. Say the one who is having the problem, I am bound, you know, was real. Then you are bound, right? The one that you take yourself to be that says, I am bound, is bound, because that is who you are. This is really kind of a funny situation. Because that is who you are, you say, I am bound, and that's the satyam. Then you are bound, and then you have to accept that. You have to live your life as a bound person. A bound person means that you're subject to change, you're subject to birth and death. You were born, and you will die. And on the way, you will grow old, and all of these type of things, and you will have sukha and dukkha, sorrow. You will have all of these sorrows. In the end, you'll die. That's what the situation be. This is the reality, and so then you have to cope with that. Okay? So the mithya jiva is suffering the mithya bondage and is going to suffer, is going to enjoy the mithya moksha. And the mithya bondage becomes the mithya moksha in the recognition by that jiva, by that buddhi, that, oh, in fact, I have never been bound, I have always been free. Of course, the one who is saying, I have always been free, is mithya. Right? The words, I have always been free, the antakarana of the mind that is saying, and the voice, the vak that is saying, I have always been free, all of these things are mithya, right? So the mithya jiva says, I was bound and I have been, and I am free. From the standpoint of myself, I'm not saying anything. The nice way to understand it, again, is to go to the dream drishtanta, the illustration of the dream, and you can see, you know, imagine a dream situation, just a dream situation where the dream guru comes and there are dream students, and the dream teaching is taking place. The Vedas or Vedanta is being taught very, very clearly. The students are all little dream mumukshus there. Really, uttama adhikaris. They're great. They're real mumukshus there. The teaching is taking place. And each one of these students is listening intently, you know, listening intently with their hair on fire, so to speak. And as the teaching is taking place, each mumukshu, each one of the mumukshus is seeing clearly, saying, in fact, I am not this body, mind, sense organs. This is not my real nature. I am the non-dual self, you know, which in fact is the self in all beings. I recognize it. And they're not kidding. They're not just in their head. They're seeing, my being, in fact, my being never changes. My being never changes. My being, the self that I am, it is never objectified. It's not an object in the world. You know, this self that I am is not an object in the world. It can't be divided. I don't have any parts to me. In fact, the self that I am has to be the self that you are, because if I can't objectify myself and you can't objectify yourself, actually this whole creation, including my body, mind, sense organs, all of this is just existing in my being, this the me, the amness, what I say is I, this what I'm pointing to is I, that is who I am, and that is non-dual. I am non-dual. I am the non-dual Atma. I am the one self. Okay? Now, everything it is saying is true. It has recognized it. See that? This dream, mumukshu, has gained self-knowledge. And all of the bondage that it had attributed to the self, it has been released from in the recognition that the self that I am is free of these things that are bound. This body is bound. The dream body is bound. The subject to birth and death, the dream sense organs are bound. The dream thoughts are bound. The dream ahankara, I notion, all of these things are bound. They're subject to birth and death. They exist within duality. All of these things are bound. But these things are asat. All of these bhavas are asat. They have no real being. They are mithya. They enjoy me for their being. But the difference is they enjoy me for their being, but I am free from them because I notice my being never changes. I can notice that my being never changes because my being is consciousness and I am self-evident, shining there amidst all of these varied and changing experiences. Consciousness is the me, which is self-shining, just always remains exactly the same. And that me never comes and goes. The buddhi of this dream character recognizes all of this. But this dream character, the total dream character, the body, the mind, the sense organs, the buddhi, the mumukshu, the ones who has the guru, who is receiving this wonderful teaching, who is being set free. This mumukshu, who has now become a great jnani and liberated, right? And has a wonderful guru who is so exalted, such a wonderful teacher, you know. This is all part of the Maya. It all exists within Maya. It's part of the dream. All of the dream mumukshus, the dream guru, the dream teacher, the dream Vedas, all of these exist within Maya. They're all asat. They all have no independent being. They come into being and go out of being as a grand picture, as Ishwara comes into being and goes out of being. That's why I said in the previous verse, there's no creation and there's no dissolution. Because you can't have a creation or a dissolution or a jiva or a mumukshu or a jnani or all of these things are not asat. They're not. It's like giving these attributes to something that has no being. Yeah. It has no being in reality. And so even though from within the story, from within the duality, this is all very real, and the release, the moksha also, for the asat, for the mithya jiva, who feels bound, the mithya moksha is a huge relief. Right? It's not pretend. In this order of reality, it all plays out very, very nicely. But you know what? Gaudapada doesn't really care about this order of reality. What he wants you to see is that actually this whole play is mithya. From your standpoint, from the standpoint of yourself, there's no creation, there's no dissolution, there's no bondage, there's no moksha, there's no student, there's no teacher. There's just simply your being, which is infinite wholeness. And that infinite wholeness is not subject to any type of duality whatsoever. So these appellations, you know, that I am... that I am this body, or I am this mind, or I am this sense organs, or I am the non-dual Brahman. Mm. All of this talk belongs within, exists within Maya. And even though the talk, the knowledge is useful, the knowledge gives a result. You know, just because it's in Maya doesn't mean that it doesn't give a result. Like, for instance, in Maya, there's all the laws of nature. In Maya, you can go heat some water and have a cup of tea. You know, you can actually accomplish things. You can heat water and have a cup of tea. Because there's all of these laws that allow all of this kind of stuff to take place. But all of the stuff that is taking place is all mithya. It has no more substantial reality than the dream. So, first part of this Vaitecha Prakarana. All of this has no more reality than the dream from the standpoint of the self. The dream world is very real from within itself. You know, when you're having a dream and you're identified with a character, within the dream, that mithya stands as real and it has its own laws and whatnot. For us, within the mithya, within this Maya, within this creation, it's all very real. It has all of its laws and its order. But for from the standpoint of the Atma, whether we're looking at the dream or we're looking at the waking state, both are equally mitya. It's not at all that this world is viewed as less mitya than the dream. Not at all. Not from the standpoint of the Atma. The dream, this world is mitya, the dream world is mitya. It's from the standpoint of the waking state, I can look at the dream and say, oh, that's mitya. I can understand, that's maya. I can understand very clearly that that has, and it comes from me, is sustained by me, resolves into me. It doesn't really touch me in any way. So we use these words sometimes, which are actually dangerous words, that we say, it's an illusion. It's an imagination. You know, it's a hallucination. Whatever words we want to say, you know. Because we see that it has no substance. When we wake up from it, we see that it doesn't enjoy the same substance as this does. But actually, when we wake up from this, just from our from knowledge, what we realize is that this world that you're experiencing right now with this body, mind, sense organs, through your sense organs and your mind, this world, even experientially, is as mitya as the dream world. Because what is the substance, what is the content here, is the one non-dual conscious being. That is what is the substance. That's what gives the firmness. That's what gives the weight or the substance to this creation. Just like in the dream, you say that dream is mitya after you've woken up from it, and so the dream, you know, has no substance. But when the dream is there, of course it has substance. It has substance of the Atma. The substance is the Atma. The substance is the self. It's exactly the same here. The substance is the self. And so he's saying two things now. First thing to understand is in this world, this Atma that you're experiencing, you take to be identified with the body, mind, sense organs, or you take it to be non-dual, based upon your knowledge, upon your understanding. And on the looking at it in just the opposite way, this is that anyonya adhyasa, he says, and all of these things that you experience also from their own standpoint. So first it's from me. From my standpoint of the Atma, as the me, the self, I take myself to be this body, mind, sense organs, and whatnot, the prana, etc. Then from the standpoint of these objects, I take these objects to be me. This is what we mean by the anyonya adhyasa. All of these things gain selfhood. This body becomes me. My thoughts become me. The sense organs become me. And I become them. This anyonya adhyasa. Now, what he says, after saying these two things, going both ways, anyonya adhyasa means mutual superimposition. Mutual superimposition is where each side gains the other. It's mutual. So that means, just to review this so that you understand, when I say the anyonya adhyasa, superimposition, anyonya mutual, I, the me, I become one who is a physical body. I take on the qualities of this physical body. I take on the qualities of the mind, the qualities of the sense organs. So I become someone who has these attributes. I am this body. I am the sense organs. So I think, and therefore I am happy. I am sad. I am at such and such an age, etc. I take on body, mind, sense organs. I become these things. And the other side of it is that this body becomes the conscious being. From its own standpoint, it becomes the conscious being. The mind becomes the conscious being. So the mind takes on consciousness, and I take on the qualities of the mind. The body becomes the me, the conscious being. I become the body. I become subject to all the qualities of the body. That's the anyonya adhyasa, the superimposition. After he's looked at this in both from both sides, and then with this little keynote saying that this buddhi, it's really the buddhi, that takes it all to be, it takes myself to be either the body, mind, sense organs, or takes myself to be non-dual. No matter which way we do the anyonya adhyasa, which way do we do the superimposition, the one thing that remains as the constant is the self. The one that's always there in the terms of anvaya vyatireka, not that, you know, I'll tell you that in a minute, the one that is always remaining there in my experience is the self. Now, no matter which way I look at it, everything else except the Atma, conscious being, comes into being and goes out of being. It's subject to birth and death. It's subject to sukha and dukkha. It's subject to change. No matter which way I do this mutual superimposition, the one that always wins out, the one that always remains steady, is the Atma. And so then he says, Tasmat, therefore, it's this Advaita, it's this non-dual one, it's this the non-dual self, the non-duality itself, that is auspicious. None of this other stuff is auspicious. Anything that is subject to objectification, anything that comes into being and goes out of being, is subject to pain, is subject to birth, is subject to death, is subject to dukkha. And so therefore, not auspicious. You know, we don't want to identify ourselves with something that dies, you know, that something that changes its nature. And so if it changes its nature, you can't depend upon it. You can't say, oh, this is auspicious, but it's only here for a few minutes. This is auspicious, but it's going to leave. Okay, so that auspiciousness, that Shiva, is something which is contaminated by time. Right? What we say is auspicious in the world is contaminated by time. It's a temporary auspiciousness. You know, if I say, oh, this is such a blessing for me, but the blessing is leaving. Right? This is such a grace for me, but Bhagavan's taking the grace away. Like that. That's not Shiva. The only thing that is really Shiva is Advaya, is that Advayata, that state of non-duality. State of non-duality means of your own being, the truth of your being, is something that's not touchable. And so all of this that we experience, it's so interesting. In all of every moment of your experience, whether it be the dream world or this world, or the deep sleep, where all of this dvaita is actually not in manifest condition. There, in every moment of your experience of this mitya, the satyam is fully present. What is really the satyam, which is the advaya, that non-dual being truth, is fully present. With the satyam mitya relationship, you can't pull the mitya off the satyam. Right? Mitya means that for its being, it is totally dependent upon something else. That's why we use these two drishtantas, the rope snake, right? The rope snake and the clay pot, to really so that you really understand. Clay pot is easier, and actually that's the key. Clay pot is more powerful than rope snake, and is really what's the main drishtanta in the Upanishads for satyam mitya. With a clay pot, there is only clay there. There's a pot, but really there's only clay. That's advaita. We don't even, this is the other thing, the point Gaudapada is making here. Here we have a clay pot. Okay? From the standpoint of the clay, there's only clay. It's only from the standpoint of the pot that you have to acknowledge, I am actually the clay. Clay doesn't have to. From the standpoint of the clay, there's nothing here but clay, so there's nothing to acknowledge. It's only from the standpoint of the pot, the mitya, that we have a question. So the mitya pot can say, I, the pot, am the clay. And when I break, the clay will be gone. I am the clay. That and that's our situation where the satya mitya is not there. Satya mitya means the pot must realize, yes, I am the clay and the clay is free of me. I'm dependent on the clay, but the clay is not dependent on me. That's the anvaya vyatireka. When the pot is, the clay is. When the pot is gone, the clay still is. That's the satya mitya. The pot is, the clay is. The pot is gone, the clay still is. The body is, the body enjoys me. If the body is the conscious being, right? So when the body is, conscious being is there. When the body is gone, same conscious being is there. When the mind is, conscious being is there. When the mind is gone, conscious being is there. When the body is, I am. When the body is gone, I still am. That's the satya mitya. That amness is what is auspicious. It's only from the standpoint of what actually is there that we have auspiciousness. Because then I can just say, this is what's auspicious. I am, and nobody can do anything about it. My I am, period. I am, period. Satyam is untouchable by mitya. There are two orders of reality. This is what has to be understood in the satyam mitya. There are two orders of reality. If there are two equal orders of reality, then it's not satyam mitya. There's this thing, there's this snake lying on top of this rope. You know, that's the same order, the same order of reality. You know, there's a pot stuck on top of the clay. That's one. There's two things in one order of reality. In one order of reality. Here there are two orders of reality. One, the mitya, is dependent upon the satyam. But from the standpoint of the satyam, there is no mitya. Where's mitya from the standpoint of the clay? The clay can never find the mitya. The clay can't find the pot. Because from the standpoint of the clay, there's only clay. It's only from the standpoint of the mitya that this debate exists. So the ajnanam, this jiva is suffering from ajnanam, from self-ignorance. It has to recognize its own mityatva. Right? It has to recognize its own mityatva. The mitya has to recognize its mityatva. Right? What is mitya? Has to recognize that it is mitya. And it's only going to recognize that it is mitya by a mitya pramana, by a mitya means of knowledge to teach it that. Because from the standpoint of the satyam, there is no mitya. You see that? There is no mitya. So all of this problem, the moksha and the liberation, all of it is taking place only from the standpoint of the mitya. The mitya is not auspicious because it is not. But what is auspicious is what actually is. And the mitya, which is not auspicious, only because it's coming and going and you can't count on it for anything, so it's, of course it's not auspicious. But what is actually there, totally, is totally auspicious. It's like saying the pot is not auspicious, but the clay is. Well, if you say the pot is not auspicious, but the clay is, actually there's nothing there but clay. Yeah. But the clay has to be recognized. The pot is suffering until it recognizes that the only thing here is clay. So we are suffering until we recognize that all of this is only my being. And that my being, nothing is happening to me. And it's not only that nothing is happening to me, nothing can happen to me. The mitya is a different order of reality. You know, it's a different order of reality. It doesn't have the capacity to touch that which itself is not objectifiable as one of the objects in Mithya. That's why in the Bhagavad Gita, they talk about Brahman, the self, as that which it can't be cut, it can't be burnt, it can't be dried. There's nothing in the space, air, fire, water, earth that in any way can harm you or touch you in any way. And so what when you, this Mithya Jiva, Mithya mind, you know, gains this Mithya Jnanam, the Jnanam that it's gaining is removing the ignorance that causes this Anyonya Adhyasa, this superimposition, to be imposed upon the self-shining nature of you. Right? You are. And nothing is ever happening to you. Your mind is in trouble because of ignorance. But when that ignorance is removed, then the mithya mind gets to be the mithya mind. The mithya body gets to be the mithya body. The mithya laws, the mithya science, the mithya creation gets to be the mithya creation, because none, and with freedom, because my being is Shiva. My being is indestructible, untouchable, is always exactly the same. So what happens, as we'll see when we go on to these verses, for the jnani, for the one who has this knowledge, this mithya jnani, who has this knowledge, right, the drishti for that mind, for that mithya mind, is really, drishti means that vision or the attitude, is really a praman or pramana, pranams, you know, to the Shiva, the auspiciousness of my own being, the changelessness of my own being, because that the nature of my being is ananda. It is actually what I was trying to get out of this mithya. Right, the mithya jiva is trying to get ananda out of the mithya world. It's like the asat, that which has no being of its own, is trying to gain ananda, fullness, being, out of that which has no being. What has no being is trying to get ananda out of what has no being. Mithya is, you know, screaming around in mithya. But that type of situation stops once the ananda or the wholeness that you've spent your life seeking is recognized to really be the nature of your own being, and that's the Shiva. That's why he says, Gaudapada is very, very terse. He says these couple of lines, and he says, therefore, non-duality is Shiva. The Advaita is Shiva. Once you've recognized all of this, that it's Mithya, what is left is Satyam. And the Satyam is the reality. That is what is Shiva. That is what is Ananda. That is what is whole. That is what is complete. And that is who you are. That's what's auspicious. That's what you're seeking. That's what blesses you. Auspicious is that what blesses you. It's the non-duality itself is the blessing. Mm-hmm. It's the Shiva. Mm-hmm. So that's good. Let's stop there.
Can't be any better.
Yeah. Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha. Hari Om.
So it's the mind that nitya mind that attains moksha.
Yeah.
And so it harks back to my question from last time. The mind is fickle. It's changing.
Yeah, but you see, the thing is, you have to remember, it's a little tricky, because what is mitya can't even be there without satya, right? It's like the pot can't be there without the clay. But the pot has to recognize the clay in its own right. And like that, this mind has to recognize the self in its own right, from its own standpoint, not just from the standpoint of the mind. Until that viveka, that discrimination is there, the mind recognizes fully the self. The self isn't hidden. You know, it recognizes fully the self, but as its self. Mm-hmm. And when it does that, it takes the self that it recognizes as itself, takes on all of the gunas, all of the qualities of the mind. And so that means when itself is, when the mind is happy, itself is happy. This is that anyonya adhyasa, the superimposition. And so what has to happen is that the ignorance that has caused the mind to totally identify this mutual superimposition with the self needs to be broken. That ignorance has to be removed. And then when it's removed, the mind clearly recognizes itself as something which is objectifiable, that is coming and going, is continually changing, in that which is absolutely stable. See, in your own experience, you can notice it now as it's kind of a mirror is being held up to that fact, is that your being, the me, your own very personal self, never changes at all. It's never hidden. It's never covered. Nothing ever happens to it in any way, nor can it. And that is really the very being in which all of this mitya is coming and going. So you notice that in your own experience. In fact, not just in all experience that you have, this satyam mitya is there. The satyam self and the mitya mind. The satyam self and the mitya duality.
So if the mind makes that viveka and notices it, it seems like you were saying last time, it can never go back to forgetting it. I mean, because it seems like the mind could, like, kind of lose track and then maybe come back.
I make a distinction there. That is one stage. It loses track when it hasn't fully recognized. But when it fully recognizes, I think this is a better way, in my mind, of explaining this. It, once the mind, it recognizes you, your own presence, and the stability and changelessness of your own being, okay? But it is habitually used to seeking ananda in from the world. That's the bugaboo right there. That because it's just insidious. It's in every part of our psyche somehow, that my fullness, my well-being is dependent, you know, upon having this way and this and that way. So the mind just habitually is continually falling out into that extroversion, right? Seeking happiness out here, seeking bliss experiences, so seeking joyful well-being. Okay? And that kind of habitual behavior is what drops off slowly. And as that it drops off with your own understanding, it takes its own time to drop off. And the more it drops off, the more natural shanti your mind enjoys. And so what you realize that takes place more gradually is the mind's assimilation you know, of your knowledge in reference to its pursuit of ananda. It's the pursuit of ananda, really, my happiness, which is continually being superimposed onto the world, that causes all of the problem, really. Even when we talk about vairagya, you know, dispassion, it's all about ananda. You know.
Now, but also, it just seems it's so habitual.
Totally habitual. Exactly.
It's not necessarily even seeking ananda. It's just that it's used to thinking about things a certain way.
That's right. Exactly.
And it will fall into the ananda trap, so to speak. But,
that's right. Yeah. It's
but sometimes it just—it's like, you know, there's a way that it's used to doing things, and that's not easy.
That's absolutely true. But there's another little subtle thing that.
Okay.
It's just something for you to notice, because I think this is subtle and maybe it's not teased out that much, but I'll just throw it out there. Once you have recognized yourself, which for whatever reason is no easy feat, even though once you do recognize it, you can't imagine how you could not have recognized, but nevertheless, it takes time. One of the reasons being, I think, is that we are probably... because of the word ananda being translated as bliss, we are always looking for the self in terms of a state of mind, okay? Happy experiences. So when happy experiences are there, well, then there's myself. No, Swamiji, I remember so many times Swamiji always being asked this question, I'm sure by me also, you know? It would be like, when will I, you know, I'm happy and I recognize myself, and then it goes away. Yeah. Now, when I say that, it goes away, that means I'm still defining the self-experience as a vritti, a shantavritti. The shantavritti is there, I'm there. Shantavritti is not there, then I'm not there, Swamiji. When will I... you know, get to experience myself all of the time.
Yeah, you want a constant shantavritti.
Yeah, but the shantavritti is not the self-experience. Your being is totally, fully present, not covered, not hidden, no matter what the vritti is. And that ananda, what we call ananda, that wholeness, is different than a shantavritti or all of these different types of bliss experiences or happy experiences that belong to the mind. You know, it's much different. It's the wholeness, the infinite wholeness of my own nature that never comes and goes. It's an ananda that is always present.
Could you say it's like a self-completeness?
Yes. It's a self-completeness that is always present. It doesn't matter what the vritti is. Okay, so that's a very important distinction, because what happens is when you really gain self-knowledge, but self-knowledge where you recognize, that is me. That is me. And that me never changes. It never goes. I am ever present, no matter what my mind is doing. Now you know. You know that. But the problem is the mind, because of beginningless time, it behaves in a certain way. It only knows to, I need this to be this way, I need this to be that way. And it's so totally conditioned, you know, in terms of what will make me happy and what will make me sad. It needs time to really assimilate this knowledge. And then you see it going out and making itself miserable, you know, and creating a lot of dukkha vrittis for yourself and all that. But you know what? Once you know yourself is still there in the aparoksha, recognized as you, in the middle of the mind creating this mess. Mm-hmm. That's what I mean. You still recognize, once you know yourself, really, and you're not making that mistake of taking yourself to be a shantavritti, you know, a quiet mind. Once you've recognized yourself, then there's, depending upon at what point in your maturity, you know, you've come to recognize yourself, the mind is still habitually running around, creating havoc, and then you keep bringing it back, you know, either you're doing inner child work or you, it's out there wanting this or wanting that, and you bring it back using all of these different devices that we've been learning. You bring the mind back home, and so I see. Then it goes out again, and then you bring it back, and you bring it back until, you know, slowly it matures. It matures in the light of your knowledge. But there's what we call an emotional lag time because of conditioning. And so all that conditioning has to raise its head in the light of your knowledge. So sometimes I've, you know, joke saying that I was in India for several years, you know, in the 70s. And and I was enjoying a lot of peace in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I came home, all of these dormant situations, you know, dormant things that were triggers, I came back into those triggers.
Mm-hmm.
And here came all the same old problems, the same old vrittis, the same old reactions. I was really shocked.
What did you do with that?
Yeah.
Well, the good thing was that what I realized, what I really realized, and it's actually very heartening, even though a little disappointing, it was very heartening, is that I realized that, yeah, everything in your psyche, really, you know, has to come up in the light of your knowledge. Because I was a different person in the sense, my buddhi, my who I was a different person coming back into the same situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened was all of these triggers came, brought emotional responses up into a different buddhi,
mm-hmm.
a buddhi that had knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the way I handled it was different, but I had to, all these things had to come up.
So did you do like the inner child stuff and all that?
Probably.
Or you didn't necessarily need to just because you had knowledge and you sort of dissolved.
It was probably just the whole gamut of things. But the main thing was that what it's coming into a different person.
Mm-hmm.
It's coming into a different buddhi. And so it's dealt with in a different way because of your knowledge and because of your because of your self-knowledge. And then those things are dropping off. But you know that dropping off process or that vairagya, that maturing of vairagya, that really takes place over time. Now, a lot of that work could have even been done before you came to knowledge. It depends. Or you can come to knowledge kind of early before you've done a lot of that work, and then you do it, you know, while you have knowledge. But it has to be done. You know, has to mature in the light of your knowledge, and, you know, it just depends on what you have inside there that needs to be.
Well, what do you say to the mind when it leaves home and goes away and doesn't come back?
Well, it always does come back. You know, that's also a really beautiful discussion we have on the website, you know, on the homepage, all of those discussions with Swamiji. There's one, I don't remember which one it is, but there's a beautiful argument that he discusses in this particular talk where when the mind gets carried away, say you're a jnani, you have knowledge, the mind gets carried away, who's going to win? Is the knowledge going to win? Or is the emotional response going to win? So always the knowledge will win. The emotional response may be like a tidal wave for the moment, but it will wear itself out, and what is left always is your knowledge. So that's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Your knowledge is there, but sometimes there's emotional upheavals that when those are there, you know, they're creating a lot of havoc. Yeah. But they will die down. And what is left is your knowledge. Because another way of saying it, you're the one that's always left. Because
mm-hmm.
you're the one, your being is the one that's ever present.
So this process shouldn't look at it as being disappointing to experience that.
You know, I still like Swamiji's example of the little child who's given a rosebud. You know, the little child's given a beautiful little rosebud, and then it's waiting and waiting for the rosebud to open, you know. And the rosebud is not opening. And why isn't the rosebud opening? And then finally it becomes so impatient, the little child becomes so impatient that I'm going to open it myself, you know. And the poor little rosebud gets all totally screwed up. But the thing is if we can kind of enjoy Ishwara's plan, you know. It's like, look at it as a flowering. The natural flowering of every jiva as you come into that kind of end game of maturation. It's a beautiful process if you can be patient, you know. The thing is there, we carry a lot of baggage. Every culture does. There's different self-criticisms and I'm not good enough, or I should be like this, or I should be like that, or this isn't happening fast enough, and all of this type of thing. But it's
noise.
At some point, you know, if you you can become more patient, you know, and you just keep doing your best and not worry about it. You know, you just do your best. Oh, I'm not a good enough person. Well, okay, I'll be a better person tomorrow. You know, and otherwise, everything's so crippling. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to give yourself the benefit of the doubt and let that process take place.
And it will.
Yeah. And yeah, it will. Yeah. And it is. Yeah. But it helps to kind of just be present to it. You know why it will? Is because the universe is your greatest teacher. Every misdirection has a little pain involved in it that kind of pushes you toward owning up your knowledge.
And it's not a task maker then.
The task maker is pain. You know, pain causes you to reevaluate and to look at what you're doing and that type of thing. Everything leads toward vairagya, really. Everything leads toward non-attachment. And in the non-attachment, there's the counterpart of that non-attachment is appreciation of Ishwara. If once you give up your own attachment to how things are, then you have the freedom to appreciate how things are. More appreciation of Ishwara. And all of these all depend upon knowledge. Also, everything we're talking about depends upon, you know, you're exposed to this pramana, you're exposed to the truth of the whole thing, the truth of your own nature. You know, as you understand the truth of your own nature, really understand, you also have the freedom to let go of things. Because you know that the more you hang on, the worse it is. I mean, it is. It's better to be the part of Ishwara that you are. To let Ishwara be. You know, but that means that you have to appreciate Ishwara rather than appreciating how you think Ishwara should be. In order for me to be happy. In order for me to be happy, this is what should be happening. This is what Ishwara should be doing, you know. And this is what I should be getting. And I'm not getting those things. So,
so something's wrong with Ishwara.
There's all so much learning. There's also, you know, in the whole Karma Yoga, there's this one thing called, there's the Ishwara Arpana Buddhi where, you know, I really focus on Dharma. That focusing on Dharma is where Ishwara comes first, Dharma comes first. Then there's Kaushalam. That's the other part. Kaushalam means that learning how to be in the world, learning how to be with others, learning how to, you know, be appropriate, you know, skillful. Sometimes they translate it as being skillful in action.
Mm-hmm.
But it really has to do with just learning how to be appropriate in the world, learning how to be big, learning how to be giving, all of these things.
And even amongst us, Kali Yuga, you know what I mean?
Yeah, because we also have in the, probably everywhere, a lot of bad habits. You know, so learning how to break some of those bad habits, learning how to be more generous, be more giving, be more accommodating, listening to others more, being less self-centered, all of these things, you know, that we have to adjust in our behavior to whatever degree we do. Because there's some behaviors that create negative feedback loops, so to speak. and those cause pain. So there's some calculum also. There's just skill, learning how to be appropriate in the world. All of that, you know.
Well, this,
if you need to learn that. I mean, sometimes people don't get the right feedback from others, and then you wonder, why am I not getting the right feedback? Then there's something to be learned, you know, because your behavior, for one, some reason that you may not even see, is not bringing the response that you would love to have from other people.
But these verses here, the Gaudapada's verses, aren't even addressing any of that. They're
mm-hmm. Who's saying?
Mm-hmm.
Nope.
Is he the word kalpita that he's using?
Kalpita.
Here, kalpita. Is it different than maya?
Well, it's a verb. That word kalpita is a verb, so that which is projected, mm-hmm. that was assumed to be, right? So it involves the adhyasa. It's a word that we use for adhyasa. Sometimes it's
okay.
Translated as projected.
Mm-hmm. Or superimposition.
Or superimposed mm-hmm. or projected, yeah. He says in this imagined, if you use that word, you have to unfold what you mean by imagined. It's a little bit of a loaded word. Because if I say, oh, I imagine the Atma as Advaya, as non-dual, mm-hmm. then imagine has that sense of that not being true. That's not the point. The point is that there's a vritti there.
But is he basically saying the whole Vyavaharika is kalpita?
Yeah.
Yes, okay.
Yeah.
That is
it. Yeah.
What did he just say?
The whole Vyavahara and Pratibhasika are kalpita.
And Pratibhasika.
Pratibhasika is the subjective.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And But this whole creation also.
Pratibhasika is the subjective aspect of Vyavahara.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. There's Vyavahara is Ishwara Srishti, Ishwara's
okay.
creation.
Yeah.
Pratibhasika is the Jiva Srishti. So like, for instance, the dream...
But he's not making any distinction between Pratibhasika and...
He's not really. No, because... you
really,
can't...
Yeah.
Not really.
Yeah.
But you can. He has, because he's using the dream drishtanta.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Right.
And that brings that in.
But in this verse, he's...
No. Not really, no. Because it doesn't really matter on whether you take it Pratibhasika or Vyavahara. It's still the same mitya.
But so then, like, even an Akhandakara vritti is...
it's all mitya.
Right?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. The whole
yeah.
thing. That's why the previous verse,
mm-hmm.
there's no bondage, there's no liberation,
mm-hmm.
there's no guru, there's no sisha. All of these things are mitya.
Right. Okay.
From the absolute standpoint.
Yeah.
Even the Vedas, the pramana...
Any vritti is...
Any vritti, any duality,
yeah.
that pramana and pramaya... The pramana and the pramaya, both. Pramana, the pramatra, the knower,
mm-hmm.
the pramana, the means of knowledge, the pramaya, the object of knowledge, all mitya.
So it's all dismissed.
It's dismissed as mitya.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise you have to say Brahman, there's Brahman and some other things that are,
right. But
there's more than one sentient.
Well, Brahman would have to go through some change.
Yeah.
Which it doesn't.
Or
be an object.
Yeah.
From the standpoint of Brahman, there is no problem at all. Nothing. There's only, from the standpoint of Brahman, there's only Brahman. Like from the standpoint of clay, there's only the clay. There's no pot there. There's only me. There's only me, the clay.
Mm-hmm.
What pot? There's nothing there except me.
And that's true even before knowledge.
Yeah. It's always true. That's the thing. All knowledge removes ignorance and the effects of ignorance. Right? It removes the, it doesn't change reality, but it removes the problem that the ajnanam is causing. That's why ajnanam is considered very powerful. Like when we use the tenth man story, you know, the tenth man thinks the tenth man is drowned in the river and goes through all this emotional turmoil. He is the tenth man. Nothing has happened at all. Except that there's the conclusion that the tenth man has drowned in the river. And it needs the old sadhu to come, the sadhu guru to come and tell that tenth man, you are the tenth man. And then he's fine. But until then, all hell had broken loose in terms of trauma and worry and fear and guilt and all of that. But then when he realizes, I'm the tenth man, where does all that go? And it's gone.
It isn't there.
It's not there. So it's all mitya. That's a really powerful mm-hmm. story. There's so many different mm-hmm. levels and aspects of Vedanta there. That are covered in that story. We done.
Well, what an evening.
Mandukya. That's why Swamiji teaches at last, because after the Mandukya.
What more can you say?
What more can you say?
Exactly. Everybody claps.
Exactly.